So the next talk is by Julian. Oh God, I forgot about it. Julian, turn your microphone on. By Julian, Julian Ignace. Learning my indigenous language in the home and community: a youth's perspective on Tsekhwepmekh language acquisition, why it matters, and how it connects to well-being.
Hi. Okay. So as I was well introduced, before I get started, I just want to quickly acknowledge and thank the Hawaiian people for bringing us into their home and into their territory and letting and inviting us to this wonderful conference here. I've already learned and met so many people and fascinating things, or you knew what I meant. Anyways, let me get started. Wait, let me go. Sulianin's quaxt. Neskijistin as aequen. Ngitha esha mpacha. A Marianne esha Ron Ignace. Mpacha as aequen. Neskijistin. Esh ngitha nes aequis na Germany. Nkhbaa ye Francis Jules. Ye estequis na Kamloops. Ash nkia ye Elizabeth or Lissy Ignas. Ye estequis na Skejiston. Hi, I am Sulianne Ignace. I come from Skejiston Indian Band, that is part of the Shuswap Nation in the interior BC. And I, my mother and father are Ron and Marianne Ignace, and my father comes from Skejiston, where I was raised, and my mother from Germany. My grandparents on my father's side are Francis Jules from Kamloops, and my father's mother, my grandmother, is from Skejiston. Okay, so now I shall get started. Who am I and what am I doing here? I am not a person who holds an undergrad degree. It is partial at best. It was in linguistics. I am a semi-fluent speaker. I would not call myself a full fluent speaker. I understand and comprehend much more than I am able to speak. And by that, I mean I cannot speak ad nauseum wherever the conversation or my brain wanders to, because I am limited by some of my own vocabulary. I have vocabulary limits that would make that difficult for me. But I do have a certificate in language proficiency, for whatever that means, from Simon Fraser University. I did finish high school once upon a time. I also, I travel, and I have been raised in my culture and in my language, and it is my life experience that has led me here, more than any sort of any official learning that I have done. This is a picture of my home and where I was raised up in. If you cannot tell from the picture here, this is actually a lot more what it's like right now at home right now, this time of year, cold, freezing, minus 5 degrees or 35 for those who like Fahrenheit. I grew up on a small little 10-acre horse ranch where we bred horses, and in a community that, when I was born, there were maybe 200, 250 people, and we are now at about sitting 300 to 350 people living on reserve. Okay, a little bit of background about my father, because I am talking about me and my life experiences. So I, in order to get to know me and to start, I need to talk about where I come from and the people who made me who I am today. My father was raised by his great-grandparents, Sulian Inyas, who I am named after, and her husband, Edward. They were born in the 1870s, roughly. No known actual date is on record. And he became fluent in Tsekhwepmekjin, our language, from them. In our culture, it is the grandparents' right to pick one of their grandchildren to take into their home and raise as their own children from their children. and they chose my father, and I will be forever blessed for that because of the wealth of knowledge my dad has from their, from what he learned with them. He is a Kamloops Indian Residential School, or KIRS, escapee. I don't think he would call himself a survivor. I think it's something that he lived through, but I think he definitely would call himself an escapee. He was one of the lucky ones. At about the time he was somewhere between 14 and 16 years old, he managed to make a run for it and get away. And he was able to avoid detection until he was 18, so he never had to go back. He has been the Skeech of my home reserve, where I grew up, since 1982. And ever since, except for maybe about 6 years that are interspersed and peppered throughout there. And also a side note, because my parents love to embarrass me at their own presentations, he loves to tell really bad dad jokes. So be on the watch for that if you engage in conversation with him. My mother is Marianne Agnes. She was raised in Friesland, Germany, born in Meppen, and grew up in Wilhelmshaven from a young age. She came to Canada and started working with Canadian First Language as a linguist and anthropologist since about the late 1970s, and she began learning Tsleil-Waututh'en in 1985 when she was doing some research. She has worked in Aboriginal language since the 1980s, and her early work was done with the Haida, which she still continues today, and but she also works in Tsleil-Waututh'en. She learned Tsleil-Waututh'en from elders in my home community in the 1980s, who were monolingual, non-English speakers, which is an amazing thing, and I am very jealous. She calls herself on the job. And I also like to tell my mom that she went beyond native by marrying the chief and having kids with him. About as native as an anthropologist can get. This here is my family. And before I go any further on this, I would like to recognize all of the elders who taught me and who I owe all of my knowledge to. These are some elders in my community. I have a picture of my namesake, who I never did know, but he taught my father everything he knows, which he's passed on to me. As well as his grandparents and some other various people. Sadly, almost all of the elders who were our teachers, mentors, and communicators have passed away since the mid-1990s. I had a conversation with my mother, and she told me an anecdote of when I was very young, a young infant, and she and my father were in a car with another community member, an uncle of mine, discussing how many fluent speakers there were at the time in the early 90s. My father, who said, well, about 12, which to him was all of the old time speakers who grew up as Shuswap was their first language with minimal to no exposure to English, and who had a lot of what is sort of known as old language and vocabulary. And then another person in the car came up with the number 50, which is conversational fluency. So the ability to speak and understand and to be able to talk on a wide variety of topics with very little limitation. And between them, my mom sort of taking those two people into a factor sort of came up with the number of about 25. Though today, there are 12 speakers living, 12 fluent speakers. Some of these are silent speakers, meaning elders in our community who do not speak the language publicly at all. And a lot of this I'll tie into later. And some are semi-fluent with great understanding, but little ability to speak in great conversational length. These people are all in their late 60s, with maybe one or two exceptions. And with them, the rest of them being in their 70s to early 90s. The language is used in very limited functions within our community, prayers at a community gathering, speeches, and a few words in dialogue here and there, sort of as throwaway sort of dialogue words here and there, but very little amongst each other in general conversational use. We do have a band-operated school, First Nations band school, with very limited language learning, with a maximum of three hours per week, with 3 hours per week that most students are getting of exposure. Some other general knowledge about my language here. I'll sort of just pop that up for a second. Disclaimer, a lot of what I'm going to say from here on out is basically my autobiography, so you get to hear me talk about myself from here on out. My early language learning. I learned the language from a young age. I was very lucky and fortunate enough to be raised by two fluent speakers in my language, both my mother and my father. My mother being a linguist, she documented much of my early language learning and my vocabulary from a young age. Sort of a bit more about myself and my household and some of the difficulties. They were, though some of the prime difficulties I will talk about is that all of my input in the language, about 98% of it came from my parents directly. So that was all the consistent input that I got was only from my parents. And that was one of the great difficulties because my parents, they did try to set up a language nest in our community and were unsuccessful, and nor were they successful in setting up or being able to find an elder caregiver who was fluent in the language and could speak and spend some time with me as a sort of child care. Some sort of observations my mother made, which I will sort of, apparently by the age of two, I had a vocabulary of 200 words in Sukwetmukjin. I had a repertoire of 50 utterances and an equal number in English, sort of between 13 to 22 months. I had many single morpheme utterances, and which were very reductions and simplifications of much more simple words, like gach, give for gach jechma, give to me, titsa for stick titsa or shirt, taus for 10 taus or to ride or to ride a horse. And what my mom told me many times when I was growing up, my first word was gacha, short for ntsiskacha, for horse. Along with my siblings, with English first language, older siblings, I got a great amount of English input from them and from sort of friends and other general cultural input, TV, radio, music, etc. But there were words in everyday use that I kind of got put into that I understood. So some utterances were phone for huddal quitten. That's what I use for phone, but I splutchen, mouth, and ta'a, no. Just some general statistics from a graduate student who did some research and used me as a guinea pig, sort of using me as a First Nations language young child learner, and sort of where that left me. There's some code mixing that I did. I believe one is one that my sister Lizzie once said was "Mommy, I poonded," which is "Mommy, I farted." Translating, one difficulty I did have, and one of the main reasons why I did not grow up with full fluency, is my parents were unable to play deaf. And there were some mitigating factors to that, but that was one of the main, that was probably one of the biggest difficulties they had in being able to play deaf to a young child who is tugging at your skirt, screaming and crying. You know, it's just easiest to go with the path of least resistance, as all parents in the room know. Constructing grammar. As I got older, I started peppering my... I went from sort of mixing codexes to constructing grammar and sort of inserting English grammar into my Sohuat Mokjin. Through that, I sort of would try to correct my mom by saying, sort of correcting the plural for sielt, which is plate, and the plural for that is sielt. And I would tell my mom, no, mom, you have to say sielts. Now, fast forward several years later, from the time that I was 14, I started to pick up my language learning again, making an effort once more, realizing how much I had lost and my lost opportunities and the fact that I had not been able to stick myself in the language as my first language. Eventually, around in 2013, along with two other young people, I did a First Peoples Cultural Foundation grant, which is a branch of the Department of Canadian Heritage, and funded from them. It was the Master Apprentice Program, the MAP program. They're around here doing some presentations, actually. And as well as a documentation project. And I spent some 300 hours in the language, sort of doing my best to immerse myself. Eventually, I reapplied for an independent MAP grant in 2015 and again in 2016. I'm just actually about to wrap that up at the end of the month. The amazing things about the MAP grant is that it stresses oral proficiency over the ability of writing, and you spend as much concentrated time in the language as you can. It's all about immersion. So things I have learned are sort of, at the end of every 100 hours I completed of the three, there was a oral proficiency interview component that was designed by my mother and in the presence of another elder and my father, where they quizzed me on my ability to answer and reply simple and to more complex languages. Who am I? Where do I live? Who are my ancestors? What do I do? What things do I like to do? So on and so forth. Additional tasks were to describe what I'd seen in previously unknown photos to me. What objects do I see? What people? What are they doing? What are they wearing? Are they happy or sad? And so on and so forth, with the questions and the answers getting more and more complex. One of the things that I focused on mainly was telling stories with wordless picture books. So these are stories that are done by Mercer Mayer. Does anybody remember his children's books? Little Creatures, I believe, or something like that? Little Critters? Anyways, he, along with his wife, published a series of books that are... the series is A Boy, A Dog, and A Frog, and it's all about the adventures of a boy and his dog and a frog who eventually becomes their friend. And these are some pictures I took of the first book in that series. And these stories, while simple in their pictures and very easy to figure out, I found out when I started to try to tell these stories in my language using full and complete grammar, are much more complex than I originally thought. So, I told you a bit about myself. What does this all have to do with well-being? Colonialism, stress and trauma. Colonialism, there were sort of in the first advent and wave, there was massive losses of population, which everybody knows about. And then following the next step of colonialism was residential school, a cultural genocide, which left many emotional scars, losses of identity, leading to a lost self, which eventually led to an entire multi-generations being lost. A culture that was initially built around the extended family unit centering itself around the children, that does not leave behind easy scars when the state declares you an unfit parent to your children for no reason other than you are different and not white. And also, there is a stress factor. A language survey my mother conducted with Heltzuk and Tsukenya communities in 2001 revealed that stress and trauma were seen as major factors preventing people from getting on with learning language. And that leads me to a little final bit. In 2003, both my family and my community suffered three devastating losses of death in our community, all within the span of maybe about 4 months. For a community that was at the time about 300 people, three deaths in 4 months, in the span of 4 months, is a lot. And it was a lot of grief and trauma. And that was one of the things my mother has told me a lot, that after the death of my brother, English became the default. It was very much more easily, it was much more easy to fall into the default of English than to put extra brain effort and activity in focus into beyond English, into Sopat Mokshin, to sort of enforce to enforce the no English rule. However, there is hope and optimism. Healing wellness. Having spoken to active welders, both the masters and the language speakers that I know, all of them being elders over the age of 70 who attended residential school, the common thing I found among their stories is about the point in life where they returned to speaking their language, that they were able to put away and shake off a lot of the hurt and shame and reclaim their identity of self and their community. Also, I am a great believer that language is a unifier. Lost people can find home and a sense of belonging and your identity of self and who you are and where you come from is restored. And there I have some tips and tricks for learning language, learning and teaching, which I will only stress the first one, which is there are no shortcuts. Trust me. I learned the hard way. I even tried looking up and doing a bit of research on a Matrix, you know, the movie Matrix, some sort of way to plug my brain in and learn my language, but unfortunately we're nowhere near being able to do that. Anyways, I have been given the time's up signal. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah, questions and comments. Anybody? Yes?
You mentioned that in the first attempt to set up a language unit was unsuccessful.
Yes, my parents did have made a couple attempts to set up language nests, but there are difficulties in our community. One, we are a remote community, and about 45 minutes by car away from any sort of semi-decent-sized city. The closest one being Kamloops, which is 80,000. We still don't have cell phone reception there to this day. So distance from other places and larger populations. And two, being the fact that a language nest requires both people who have early education training and knowledge in the language, which is very difficult to find in amongst our people, and would require a great investment and time and the willingness to be able to set something up like that. Something we sadly don't have at this current time. Any other questions, comments?
I'm the mom. if I could speak to that. You've heard we're a small community, and then you have, depending on who you talk to, but at the time we had less than a dozen speakers in the language. How many able-bodied ones we had reduced that pool. And so one of the difficulties was at any given time, who's available to actually run the language nest. I frankly would have to quit my job at the university to do that. And I think as I see somebody nodding there, we're as parents in that situation, we tried to cajole some of our sort of colleagues, including the local daycare, into shutting down and starting something fresh. But that's not as easy as it sometimes sounds. And I think many people in our community have been in that situation. Others have been successful, and it just didn't work out at the time.
Yes.
Yeah, it's sad when it it's a stage where school has to teach us our language again.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Australia, we've doing the same thing in our little community of Hawthorne.
Mm-hmm.
And Lillian is a Gugu Yimitar teacher, so we're teaching our people how to speak the language from school age now.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the education system only gives us an hour at the most during the day to teach to keep that language alive.
And that's sort of one of the things with our local band school. Yes, we do have a language teacher, but like I sort of said earlier, two things of note. It's a lot of the language they get taught is very simple. So adjectives, nouns, cat, dog, black, blue, colors, numbers, etc. So the language basics, the ABCs, right? And also the fact that they do not get enough time. And then sort of one of the compounding facts is that they may learn some sort of beginning competency and fluency, but that is not carried on later on in life, unfortunately, because because there is one big, much bigger factor that we face especially amongst the adults and the parents in our community, which is apathy. And or not necessarily apathy, where the parents will say, oh yes, the language is very important, but it is not a priority, it is not a high priority work, you know, kids' extracurriculars and everything like that. It's not something that is where time is made for. So this sort of passes along to their kids, unfortunately, that it is not a high priority that we must learn. And but sort of, I get into that a little bit about making sure to teach children the importance of their language. Yes?
So what would be some recommendations that you would give to some of us who are language teachers to help young people?
Well, if you're working with the young kids, total physical response, or TPR, are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
TPR is one of the best things for young kids up to the age of 10 to 12, I think is definitely one of the biggest things. And sort of getting them to, you know, speaking as much as you can, trying to enforce as much no English as you can, are sort of things number one. Make it fun. Come up with as many silly games, you know, Simon Says, if you are in lack of resources, and storybooks. Take some early reader, you know, those simple early reader sort of English novels and type out how that story would translate. You know, the dog is black. Well, type that out and put it and paste it over, and glue and paste it over the English in the book. So, you know, this way they're getting, they can sort of see these kind of resources. For older kids, it's a matter of keeping them engaged, and sort of once they get into more high school age, is sort of impressing upon them, I think, that is to maintain that interest, I think would be to stress the importance of why they should be doing this, why they should be doing everything they can. And telling them, you know, how important this is, and sort of tying the language back into their culture and showing them about their identity and sort of how that ties back into their identity as who they are as a First Nations person. And, you know, maybe even if you are lucky enough to have elders in your community or nearby who can come and speak to them and tell them, talk to them. Yes. Yes. Was there another hand? I didn't notice another hand, so yes.
I just wanted to say that I can relate very well to the situation on your reserve. I'm a language teacher, and I only have each child for 1 hour a week. And when I calculated that for my school board, including all the disruptions to my class time, it added up to about 2 days of instruction from August to December, half of a school year. And we know that language is much more time consuming than that. I don't know how in the world we expect to produce speakers being given so very little time to work with these children. Now, that's just to help you get the people to understand how hard this is for those of us who are actually in the trenches doing the work. My question to you is, I found out that as an English or as a language practitioner, I need to be respected. You know, I've got the training to be a teacher trainee, but I can't get that respect. And so one of the things I've had to do was say, don't let people walk over you. Who's going to do this work if you don't do it? And I'm up in age, I'm already looking at who's going to take over after me. And so I'm wondering, I've set some goals for myself. I've empowered myself, and I said I'm going to the reservation-wide school board to make a presentation and some of these other little plans. But I'm wondering, what are your personal goals right now? What are you doing to continue this language work that you're talking about?
Okay, so that's quite a... personally speaking, how I would grade myself and how I believe also the elders around me who have taught me would grade myself, let alone my mother, the professor, I would grade myself as a semi-fluent speaker, a sort of early mid-level speaker where I have really great fluency, but like I said earlier, I don't have a great conversational skill. So my focus right now, especially in the next couple of years of my life, while I have the luxury of speakers and elders around me, is to increase my fluency as much as possible. And when I am afforded the opportunity, I will teach to anybody who wants to teach. I am more than happy to pass on resources that I have and, you know, what little knowledge I have before me. That right now is my main goal. I do not have a teacher's degree. I have taught a little bit in classrooms for mostly adults, but my main goal right now, because I do have the luxury of a bit more time on my side in terms of my age, but not necessarily the age of the elders and my teachers, is to increase my fluency as much as possible before that opportunity is no longer possible to me. Okay, any others? Hi. Thank you. I know. Alrighty. I think that's it.